This is Dick Kresman, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 4th of April 2012. Dick Kresman, Part 1.
Richard Kresman, London, 28446.
What sort of education did you have, Dick?
Well, the usual, O-level, A-level, then to Bristol University.
To read?
Initially to read physiology, but then I switched to electronic engineering.
Was there a good reason for that?
Well, yes, physiology wasn't... I mean, physiology is basically the... engineering of animals, plants and animals. But I decided I was really much more interested in the perhaps rather narrower field of electronics.
The physiology came in rather handy later on, though, didn't it?
It did, yes.
Which you may come to with poor old Ken Portwine later on in the interview, yeah. Can you remember what it was that made you first become aware that there was a place called the Antarctic?
Oh, way back, Bunny Fuchs and TAE. As I recall, they did a sort of UK tour. It must have been, I suppose, in about 59, 58 perhaps. No, that would have been too early. And, yeah, they came to Watford, which is where we were living at the time. So I was aware of it then.
Did you go and see the tour?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What are your memories of that?
A snow cat. That's about all.
Was Fuchs with it?
I really can't remember. No. Gosh.
A long time ago. But, I mean, did that... Was that the... a pivotal moment? Did you...
Not especially, no. But it was definitely interesting. I mean, as a kid, well, compared with today, I'm a sort of fairly adventurous childhood, but
yeah, how do you
mean? Was nothing special in those days. I did do a lot of camping and so on and so forth. And a lot of boating. Father was into boats. So we
outward bound type stuff, you mean?
Yeah, that sort of thing, yeah.
What sort of career did you have in mind when you were doing your degree?
Initially, do you remember Heinz Wolf?
I do, in fact I met him quite recently.
Did you? Yeah. I mean, he was, I suppose, what's this, early to mid-60s, you know, he was getting a lot of TV exposure and so on. And I thought, yeah, that sounds good. I'd quite like to work at, where was it, Mount Pleasant, where he was based, his biomechanical lab and so on. In fact, the slight irony is that a school friend at the time did end up there for a while in the early 70s, working for Heinz. Yeah.
So how come your career took a different turn?
Oh, well, that was purely by chance. Coming to third year at university, the usual sort of recruiting round and so on, and quite by chance I happened to see an advert... just a little classified advert by Bass for radio operators.
Were you one?
Yeah.
You were radio ham, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right, yes. I thought, now that sounds fun. Because I was, I had it sort of in the back of my mind. Oh, God, we really don't want 9 to 5 yet. So I applied, get called up to interview in oh, what was the name of the street? Victoria. An interview with Bill Sloman. Also with him was Roy Piggott. And basically they were saying, well, we'd much rather you came as a ionospheticist.
Did you know what that was?
Which was sort of vaguely, but I wasn't, not in any detail as to the instrumentation and technology that it involved, which in those days was extremely old. It was post-World War.
So did you leap at the chance?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Signed up there and then.
Because of the adventure?
Yeah. It was, yes, it did just attract. It just sounded a fun thing to do.
What sort of training did they then do with you before you went south, so you'd be up to speed?
We had about 3 or 4 months at what was then Radio Research Labs at Datchet, just outside Slough. Mm-hmm. From, if I remember rightly, sort of early July through end of October, sailed on the Perlodan, first week or so in December, if I remember rightly.
Was Roy Piggott doing that tutoring himself?
Partly, yes, but most of the sort of practical work and so on was being looked after by someone else. I forget who now. There were a couple of us who were going south with Bass, myself to Argentine Islands, the other guy to Halley. There was a guy there who was, as a research station employee, to go down and do virtually the same job in Port Stanley. Yes, I can't remember who was actually.
What
doing
did you what
structing.
Did you What did you make of Roy Piggott?
You met him?
I haven't. No.
Oh, that you missed a treat. He's definitely one of life's characters. In some ways, he's the sort of epitome of the stereotyped mad scientist, but hell of a nice guy, very nice guy, and I mean extremely, as you would expect, extremely bright and on the ball. One of his characteristics that everyone would remark on was that he could talk the hind legs off a donkey. And in fact, the phrase to be piggoted came into use. You quickly learnt that you did not go to his office after about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because you'd be there till 7:30 at the earliest. And then when you finally sort of managed to point out to him that perhaps it was time to go home, he'd cut off in mid-sentence, and then next morning he'd pick up exactly where he'd left off.
Well, was he inspiring at all?
Yes, in many ways. Yeah, yeah.
So how did you adapt to this new science of ionospherics? And did you take it in your stride, or was it?
Oh yeah, yes, yes. I mean, I knew a fair bit of the physics and the theory beforehand, of course. The only thing I wasn't familiar with was the actual equipment that was used. I mean, the job was basically a technician's job. But good fun with it. interesting, learnt a lot.
Were you able to spot improvements that could be made to the gear?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Such as?
Well, in fact, just during the training course, amongst other things, what we used to do occasionally, every few years, there were quite a number of these sounding machines around, which was the main piece of kit, which is basically an upward-looking radar and reflects off the ionosphere. Every few years, one would be refurbished back here and then swapped with the one at either Halley or, well, say there were the three stations then, Halley, Argentine Islands and Port Stanley. And we were actually, a large part of the training was, in fact, refurbishing one of these machines to go down to Halley. And what they wanted to do now, these were incredibly ancient technology. They had a sort of mechanical clock which would set off a sounding on what schedule you wanted, whether you wanted just hourly, 1 an hour on the hour, or quarter hourly were the main schedule. What they wanted to do was to modify this clock to so that the sounding on the hour would actually do three soundings back to back at different sensitivity levels. Because, well, essentially the dynamic range of the ionosphere far exceeded that of the of the equipment, so I wanted to do three. So it was a matter of modifying the clock and then modifying the what the clock did was to set off a relay, which in turn set off other relays, which set the thing whirring. So it was a matter of modifying the clock and then modifying the main stop-start relay so it would go through this sequence of 1, 2, 3 at the three different sensitivity levels. So, yeah, that was one of the first.
That was a modification you carried out?
Yeah.
All right, OK. How did Roy Piggott react to bright young things messing about with his equipment?
Oh, he was all for it. Yeah, I mean, he was one of these. He worked for Radio Research Station, but I mean, essentially, you'd class him as an academic, as I suppose in a sort of ancillary way. So as Bass still is, but he was one of those people who, again, the sort of prime suspect there is. A guy called Tudor Jones, who was a physics prof at Leicester until he retired 7 or 8 years ago. And he used to sort of actively kick out his students, you know, his PhD and postdoc students, when he thought it was for, you know, time or past time that they went out into the real world. Whereas, you know, the opposite thing, particularly actually in academia, is a tendency to hang on to your brightest students. Mm-hmm. And so on. So he would very often organise some post for them, and then I'd say more or less actively kick them out, certainly encourage them to move on. And Roy was very much of the same sort of mould. I mean, although he didn't actually have any students in that sense, he had a a small group, including ourselves, which we were a sort of side shoot. But no, he wasn't
protective,
possessive in any way. He liked to see people, progressing and eventually moving on.
The other luminary you came up against was Raymond Priestley, of all people, who was still around.
That's true. Yes.
Tell me about that experience. What you recall?
Well, that was at the not aware of the came the briefing conferences, the recruit briefing conference. In those days, we were based down in. Down in Slough, as I say, the briefing conference was, well, the accommodation was in Corpus Christi, up here, I guess because of Sir Vivian's links with with the place. He was, how do you put it? I mean, he was one of the events. the conference basically consisted of a number of lectures, discussions, and that sort of thing. Ray Priestley put on what I guess he'd done every year for donkey's years, but it was an absolutely fascinating presentation, you know, complete with original slides and so on of his experiences on the what did they call it? Was it the Northern Geological Party?
Mm. Yes,
that got stranded for 9 months or so through the winter, and then one evening there was one of the events. The conference was a get-together at Fuchs's house on Barton Road, as it was then. And, you know, Priestley sort of held court.
But it was still fascinating. It was now, as we're talking about now, 50 or nearly 60 years after his time in the Antarctic, he could still...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Cut the mustard, could he?
He certainly could. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, he's the highlight of the conference. I mean, everyone who was lucky enough to go to the conference that he attended. I forget when he stopped doing that. I guess it wasn't that long after, actually. Because he was certainly getting... he must have been well into his 80s by then.
As a fledgling FID in the late 60s, did you connect yourself back to the heroic era at all? Were you aware of the precedence?
I don't think... Well, yes, I mean, to an extent, but... that sort of really did grab you once you got down into the Antarctic. I mean, depending where you were, I mean, at Argentine Islands, there was the old, what was known locally as the Wordy Hut, which was not the 1937 BGLE hut. You could, I guess. Now, what are the? I don't think I've got any books on BGLE, but there certainly were on base. I forget who wrote the definitive book on BGLE. Can you remember?
No, I can't. It doesn't matter.
But anyway, you know, there were sort of pictures of the ship, which was Pinola, if I remember rightly. Which they wintered over, you know, literally 200 yards down the creek from the then Bass base, and in turn, 100 yards, couple of hundred yards from the at least the site of their hut.
So you felt in the shadow of the of the Scott era, because of, you still had the tangible remnants, and you had direct contact with people,
yes,
who knew him.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I mean, one certainly read up a lot on the, you know, all the classic books. Scott, of course, has gone through various phases, hasn't he,
his reputation.
Reputation, that's right. Is, yeah. I mean, I've got, forget the guy's name, the Scott and Amundsen book where he slates him off left, right and centre. He's a bit over-harsh there. But I think at the time, certainly, and I mean it's a sort of feeling that stuck with me, is that Scott really owed his reputation to Ponting doing his lecture tour afterwards to pay off the expedition debts. And that, okay, you know, one doesn't want to be too harsh on him, but I think it's fair to say, at least, that he made a lot of mistakes that he really shouldn't have done.
We're speaking just the week after the memorial service at St Paul's Cathedral.
Yeah,
I don't know if you were there.
Yeah. No. No.
And therefore, all this spring, in the early part of this year, there's been a great deal about Scott. Are you surprised at the level of interest in the man who got there second?
Yes. Yes, it did surprise me when it started. As you say, it started appearing in the media.
At Christmas, really.
Christmas time, yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's all very complicated, isn't it? As I say, he made a lot of mistakes, which was very much a product of his background, I think. And then you've got the very much the sort of the stereotypical Dunkirk aspect, haven't you? You know, we specialise in wonderful defeats, along with some equally wonderful successes. But yes,
would you have been allowed to express that view 50 years ago, 40 years ago, when you were a young Fid?
I really don't know.
Was it the sort of things that you talked about?
Sometimes, yes. Yes, I really can't remember sort of...
You remember the trip south, don't you?
Oh, very much so,
on the Perla down.
On the Perla, yes, that was fun.
How was that? Go on, what was it like?
It was great, yeah. Well, I mean, it was a luxury cruise ship. I mean, you know the story is that Perla Dan, well, the Dan ships, Lauritsen Line ships, you know, taken part in a lot. I mean, the TAE, they went down in the Thaladan. One of the Dan ships, and then there was the Kista Dan, which became the Endurance, the Perla Dan, what was the famous one that ended up on the rocks at Macquarie not so long ago?
Yes, I know what you mean.
That was the most well-known one, I think, at the time. I'd never heard of the Perla Dan until I got to Southampton.
Well, you knew, unusual for Fidge, you knew exactly where you were being sent, didn't you?
Yes. I wouldn't say that's unusual, is it?
Well, I think quite a few Fids didn't find out till they got to Stanley where they were going.
Yes, you're right. I think that, well, at that time, yes, because again, the sort of arrangements were very different to what they were, well, what they became even in the early 70s, let alone nowadays. Yes, you're right. Well, okay, there we're talking about the sort of, I don't want to call it a divide, but a distinction between, quotes, scientific staff and
support. Yeah.
Yes, I think you're right. Yes, I think you're quite right. I think it. One thing you did when you were in Stanley was you actually got interviewed by the governor.
Oh, how was that?
Oh, amazing.
Was that Miles?
No.
Cosmo?
Cosmo.
Cosmo, yeah.
Cosmo Hasgard, that's right, yes.
When you say interview, do you actually mean...
Yeah, literally.
Interrogation.
A one-to-one interview in his study in Government House.
What for?
I think he... to be honest, I don't know. I think in principle he could sack you there and then if he didn't like the look of you, despite what Bill Sloman, Bunny Fuchs, who were the other London office, Derek Gipps, and so on thought.
So was
no,
it?
No, he had a. I mean he. He had obviously a more than nominal role in the survey.
So was it
by virtue of his position?
So was it a challenging interview? Was he probing? Or was
I
it...
really can't remember. No, I don't think so. I seem to remember it being
afternoon
terribly formal. Because again, back to the Perla. We as I say, we sailed. I think it was about the sort of 10th of December or something like that. Which meant we were got into Montevideo literally a few days before Christmas. I think we probably sailed from Montevideo for Stanley Christmas Eve or sometime like that, because we actually had, I distinctly remember we had Christmas at sea, and I'm sure it was between Christmas and New Year. And then we got into Stanley, must have been about the 30th or 31st, straight into the New Year's Day, they used to have a race meeting.
where did they get the horses from?
There. Oh, there's lots of horses.
Right.
Shepherds. Yes. I mean, they're shepherds' horses. Certainly not thoroughbreds.
Right, okay. So did they go to the races?
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, it was a big Stanley fete day would be the races. Complete with Cosmo Hasgard strutting around, complete with his, in full uniform with his ostrich feather hat or whatever, and so on. So, it was very colonial era.
Mm.
Just the last vestiges of the colonial service and colonial era.
So money was changing hands on horses and...
I guess so, yes. I mean, not something I've ever been interested, that's ever interested me. So
I guess it would have kitted you out at that point as well, wouldn't they?
That's right, yes. We got kitted out in Stanley at the... there was a Bass warehouse right by the public jetty, as I recall. Where you got kitted out, yes. Yeah.
How was that? Was that a frustrating experience?
Don't particularly remember anything, recall anything sort of particularly for or against.
And then the Shackleton took you on board.
That's right.
Then you had a rather convoluted journey, I think.
Because
that right?
Yes, that's right. Perla sailed off to, as she was specifically chartered for the Halley. Relief. And so, yes, at that point we switched to Shackleton and a good couple of months bouncing around touring the sort of peninsula area. I remember going to Signy. I think Signy was probably the first base I saw. In fact, I'm sure it was. About the only place we didn't get to during that time was South G. South Georgia remained, to me, a little bit of a sort of mystery place that everyone seemed to have gone to except me. for several years, actually. Yes.
You did some seismic work whilst you were at sea.
That's right, yes.
Were you involved with that?
Yes, very much so.
What were you yes. doing?
It tended to be a fairly miserable job, but it kept you occupied. The basic drill was that to do a seismic line, first thing you did was to throw a buoy over, which was basically a 45-gallon oil drum with hydrophones and a little radio transmitter in it. And then what you did was steam them slowly away from the buoy, throwing TNT over the back at almost as fast as you could go as you steamed away. So the hydrophones on the buoy would pick up the echo and transmit it back to the ship, where it would be received and recorded. The drill for chucking the explosive over the back, you had I forget what it was, 400-600 foot combination steel wire and electrical cable, which you had to winch in and then would be, carefully sort of folded along the deck. You winch it in using the rear winch on the ship's winch, folded along the deck, and then when it was all aboard, Peter Barker, who was running the show, would attach the charge and to the wire rope, and then wire up the detonator and stick that in, and then sort of 1, 2, 3 go, you chucked it over the back and hoped to hell that the cable fed out. See, meanwhile the ship was slowly steaming, I forget, 2, 3, 4 knots, and you hoped to hell the cable didn't snag. I gather on one occasion, when I wasn't there, it did. Caused a bit of panic. And then, it would be timed. Peter would start a stopwatch, time it. And, the idea was that shortly before the cable became tight, and while the charge was still sinking, but the cable, as I say, was still slack, largely slack, he'd press the button and set it off. And larger charges were quite impressive. I mean, you've seen film of, say, Christmas Island atomic tests, where you see the 10, 15, 20 seconds after the bang, or before the bang, but after it's been fired, you see the shockwave hit the water, and you get this sort of funny sort of shake and sudden smoothing of the surface. You get the same thing with the shockwave coming up from below, from the charges. It's a little difficult to describe, but the surface sort of jerks and then goes very flat for
a few seconds.
Before it sorts itself out after that, as that shockwave hits the surface.
And the purpose of all this was to see how deep the ocean was, right?
Yes, but no. It goes further than that. The idea is the shockwave actually penetrates the sea bottom through the rock and gets reflected off the rock strata beneath, So you actually get a little bit of a picture of what's you know, what rock formations and so on are down there. You know, the classic thing that the oilies are looking for is for an inverted dome, of ideally of sandstone, trapped beneath an inverted dome of harder rock, which the idea is the sandstone acts like a sponge holding the oil, but it can't escape through the rock at the top. And that's about my limit of the geology.
So in your capacity, were you simply at the sharp end throwing the banging?
Oh, yes, we were definitely the oiks.
So you weren't yeah. sort of looking at the charts later on to see?
Well, yes, I mean, we would look. The charts, they're remarkably difficult to really, you know, get a view of. You know, they don't tell the layperson very much. Mm. I mean, you can look at it and say, oh, yes, you can see a stratum going along there and so on and so forth. Ah, yes, but... and the same goes for the much later trick of the ice penetration radar. The geometry, I mean, it sounds very simple. You fly an aircraft over the ice with a downward-looking radar which penetrates the ice, reflects back off whatever's beneath it, whatever it's sitting on, and is received back in the aircraft. But when you start thinking about the geometry of what's going on, it actually gets quite complicated. So the picture, the raw picture that you see, is actually, I was going to say nothing like, but that's an overstatement, nothing like what the rock beneath actually is. It needs quite a lot of sort of interpretation before you get a proper idea of what is down there. And the same's true with the seismics. I mean, the seismic is still very widely used in the oil industry, except they tend not to throw TNT over the back. They tend to have what they call a gun, which is driven by compressed air. Basically, you have a thing like a pneumatic drill compressor on the deck, which charges this thing up, and then it lets out a glop of air, literally explosively. And that sends off the charges, sends off the shockwave, which is what you're wanting to see once it's been reflected.
There were a couple of calls you made at islands on the way down to Alexander Island. One was at Cygni, I believe.
Yes.
And you witnessed the plastic palace in construction.
I think it was just finished then. I think it was... I forget now, but I think it was probably the end of its first winter.
Right.
First or second winter. Yeah, it hadn't been there long, but it was largely complete, yes.
What did you make of it?
It's a long time since I read Alan's notes that he emailed me some months ago. Yes, that was a that was interesting because we met the Perla coming back out of Halley, and I think they must have got in literally just a few hours before we did. Anyway, usual drill, particularly at Cygni, there's the ship can only anchor quite a long way out, several hundred metres out, and then it's usually a rather wet journey and the launch to get ashore. There's a launch running ashore, hop in. So we all did. We'll get to this thing, and there's this big plastic hut, and someone, the front door is obvious anyway. And, of course, usual drill takes you, the outside door takes you into a lobby where you take your boots off and your anorak and that sort of thing. Take all your gear off. So did that. And it's a two-story building, of course, and most of the living accommodation was upstairs. Downstairs was lab space, mostly. And you got this rather steep and narrow stair going up from the lobby, the boot room, up to the lounge and kitchen dining room area there. So anyway, I've got my boots off, and I'm making my way to the bottom of the stair. And who's at the top? But Big Al. I guess you know him.
Al Smith, yes, I have.
Yeah, Big Al Smith. On his way out from at least one winter, if not two, I'm not sure, at Halley. And that was a serious apparition. Big Al is Big Al. And after a winter at a dog base, you know, your windproofs and so on are pretty torn, ripped, and rich. So there was this apparition at the top of the stairs, about to launch himself down. And there's me, wet behind the ears, thinking, goodness me, what have I come to? Of course, I say, first time seeing, you know, later when I got to know Big Al, you know.
You also called it Deception Island as
well.
We
did, yes.
Was that before or after the explosion?
It was just after the first eruption. Yes, the first eruption. Now, were we... You must have been... Well, it was... I forget the date of the eruption. That would help.
I think it was 67, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was 67, but, you know, the exact date to try and...
What sort of state was Deception?
Where we were.
What sort of state?
Well, it had been abandoned. I mean, yes, the eruption happened while we were at sea... Not that far away, somewhere between Sydney and the top of the peninsula, anyway. So, of course, suddenly all this panic goes up.
Did you turn round?
Well, I can't remember which direction we were heading anyway.
I mean,
we weren't heading to Deception, I don't think. So, yes.
So you detoured.
We turned towards that, yes. Then, of course, within a fairly short period, I forget how long now, was it a few hours the next day, the Chilean ship, the Plato Pardo, arrived at Sydney and took everybody off.
At Sydney? At Deception.
Deception.
Yeah.
Took everybody off. By the time we got there, which can't have been more than 2 or 3 days later, it was basically an abandoned island. And there wasn't that much damage, some, but not much from that eruption. The real damage came from the subsequent eruption the next year, which pretty well destroyed the whole base.
What did you make of Argentine Island when you got there, bearing in mind you were arriving knowing you were going to be there for 2 years? Was it sophisticated and comfortable, or the opposite?
I'm not sure sophisticated is the right word. It's certainly comfortable. First impressions, I really don't have a lot of memory of first impressions, but they certainly weren't negative.
But it didn't fill you with fear at having to spend 2 years in this...
Oh, no.
...fairly basic accommodation.
No.
John Doolan, he was your base commander.
That's right, and boss, because he was on the same project. Yes. Right.
Was that the beginning of a long association, long friendship?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, we're still very much in touch nowadays, still...
What is it about him that makes him so special?
I'm not sure I can really answer that. I mean, he was a very good administrator. I mean, he got to be the head of the Upper Atmosphere Division, and we had a very productive time. Well, it was productive right through from... when I finally got back in the early 70s and, settled down a bit. he was running the group at... our little group at Slough. The basic he recognised and acknowledged that had some capability with designing and making equipment. We took it from there. I mean, we worked together as a fairly good team.
Was he a good base commander as well?
Yes, essentially, yeah.
So tell me about the work you were doing then on Argentine Island as this new beast called the ionosphericist. Was it...
The ionosonde, yes.
Ionosonde.
Yes. Well... there was a lot of routine work in just keeping that going. The recordings were made onto film. Initially, it was actually paper, rolls of photographic paper, sort of roughly 120 size. What was. Mm. But it was, and so I forget how long a roll of paper lasted. I seem to remember it was only about 24 hours at the most, maybe a little bit less, I forget. So you had to feed it new rolls and then develop, the one that you'd taken out, just in the usual way. You had a rather crude developing machine, and you just threw a developer, fixer, wash, and so on, and hung it up to dry.
Were you in a position to read the results?
Oh yes, that was the next stage. After that was to go through the the records, and you basically measured off a few parameters. You had a thing called a daily worksheet for every hour of the day. You'd go through, let's say, measuring off about 7 or 8 parameters off the photographic image. Yes, making a note of them, and then at the end of the month you produced a big summary sheet.
Were there any surprises that cropped up? Were the results exactly what you expected, or were you breaking new ground?
It was basically... the whole game... and this covers quite a lot of these different techniques and so on, is basically what you're doing is you're I mean, your classic physics experiment is you set up an experiment and you change this and you change that and you change the other and you see what happens. You know, you sit in your Hadron Collider and send a few particles round and hope to see some collisions and so on. You're largely in control of what the experiment does. Now, when you're looking at geophysics, the Earth, ionosphere, magnetosphere, and so on, you can't control anything. What you're doing is sitting, observing, and waiting for nature to do something different. And that essentially sums it up. I mean, again, like most projects of that sort, I mean, it goes through different phases. Initially, you know, you put into a machine into somewhere like Argentine Islands. In fact, it was previously at Port Lockroy from about, if I remember rightly, mid to late 50s, or it might have been even earlier than that. And you don't really know, I mean, nobody knows what the ionosphere, magnetosphere, and so on in the area is like. So the initial phase is just to sort of get to know the beast, get to know how it behaves in its sort of normal daily, monthly, seasonal behaviour. After a while, that gets to be known. So yes, okay, that phase is done. We've done the initial sort of sketching out. Then, I say, you're into the area of waiting for things to happen. Solar flares, magnetic storms, that sort of thing. I mean, one specific reason for going to high latitudes is that a lot of it is controlled by the sun. Now, you sit here and you look at the ionosphere and you'll see a daily change as the sun rises and sets. You'll see a seasonal change, but there's still sun on the ionosphere for a significant part of every day of the year. Go to high latitudes, and of course the sun gets switched off for between 2-3 months and 6 months of the year. So you get to see a totally different regime during the winter. And yes, I mean, John was, I wouldn't say solely responsible, but for finding an effect which was known as the solar wind, which was, well, is, I was going to say, is unique to the area. That's not true, but it was the conditions of the area which basically made it prominent, stand out, so one could, nail this effect down quite a lot.
But in your time there, you're talking about these natural phenomena that you're waiting for them to turn up and present themselves. When they did present themselves, were they all things you knew about already, or were there
new? Oh, no.
There was new. There were things that were new to science.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Can you give some examples?
Gosh.
Layman's language will do.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of a good example that would... I mean, jumping forward a bit into the mid-70s, one experiment we were doing with Tudor Jones at Leicester was still looking at the ionosphere, but in a rather different way. What we were doing, we'd have a receiving station, which was at Argentine Islands, and we had two, three transmitting stations. One of them was at Palma, one was at Adelaide. Where was the third one? Gosh, I can't remember now. And that was just transmitting a pure signal out to the ionosphere, reflect off the ionosphere down to the receiver at Argentine Islands, where it was recorded. And what would happen, what we were looking for, was waves in the ionosphere, which would show up as Doppler shifts, of course. You know, the classic train whistle effect. This was just was an extension into that area of experiment and using equipment which Tudor Jones and his merry men had designed over the previous few years. They had a similar setup in the UK. One of the questions at the time was, well, the whole issue was looking at what are known as gravity waves in the ionosphere. Unfortunately, the term gravity wave is used for several different phenomena in physics, but here they're literally just waves. Travelling through the pressure waves, travelling... Well, no, they're not pressure waves, of course, because you haven't got any pressure. travelling through the ionosphere. There was a lot of discussion at the time. One of the particular... of trying to understand these waves, one of the discussions at the time, as I recall, was... was it possible for a wave or a shock wave to travel from ground level up to the ionosphere? There was a group of theorists who insisted that it just wasn't possible. The I forget the physics now, but basically at around the sort of 50-70 kilometre region... there just wasn't a propagation mechanism. But then, highly conveniently, along comes Flixborough. Remember the explosion at the Flixborough Chemical Works
in Lincolnshire?
Yeah. Up near, sort of vaguely, Grimsby Way. And hey presto, what does Tudor see on his array? A dirty great shockwave. Hit the ionosphere a few minutes later. So that was, I mean, although we weren't directly involved in his UK setup, that was a surprise and sent the theorists back to the back to the drawing board.
And those shockwaves were measured in Cambridge or in the Antarctic?
Oh, no, they were measured... I forget where Tudor's array was, but
in the
it
UK.
Was basically in the UK, yes, around the Midlands.
Right.
Yes.
OK. That's a good example. Thank you. Let me just ask you a little bit about Ken Portwine, if I might, before we move on to more science, because he suffered his illness on the base at Argentine when you were there.
That's right, yes.
And I think everybody had to... help rally around to help.
Oh, very much so.
What was sort of things you were doing for Ken?
Well, apart from sort of basic taking turn at nursing and so on, I did brush off some of the physiology stroke histology that I'd learnt at university. And also, in fact, I mean, one thing I'd done was... for a couple of years in sixth form was to work in the path lab at the local hospital. I mean, these days when you go to the doc and he takes a blood sample, it gets sent off to a central path lab, and the same is true of the of hospital as well. But in those days, most general hospitals, you know, they had their own path lab attached. I mean, that was extremely crude. But anyway, I would work for a couple of months in the summer holidays in the path lab. It's good fun, very interesting. So I'd done some of that sort of work. But anyway, yes, for Ken, of course, we didn't have a doctor on base, but what the doc down at Adelaide, who we used to have sort of daily discussions with, the first thing he was interested in, I mean, in trying to diagnose what the problem was in the first place.
Which is Mike Holmes.
That's right, yeah. It was Mike, yes. I mean, I can't remember. I think I probably volunteered and said, well, I can certainly do a red blood cell count. Red blood cell counts and what's known as hematocrit, which is the total sort of volume of red blood cells. Because I'd done lots of them. We ferreted around in this rather ancient and amazing medical chest that we had, which had everything from bone saws to goodness knows what in it, and found, there was a microscope in the surgery there. There was a... in the chest, I found the equipment that you use for doing red cell blood cell counts, and so on. So, yes, I know all about this. I can. That's easy. So we started doing the red blood cell counts and. They were falling away with time, so that gave Mike a fair bit of information. Then I started getting a little more adventurous and ambitious, and thought, right, well, what? And again, after discussion with Mike, I think this time he did suggest, he says, what I really like would be a white cell count, and in particular what's known as a differential white cell count, where, I mean, you know, there's lots of different types of white cells, and the relative numbers of them is a big indicator of infection. Now, that I hadn't had so much experience. I had done some, but not much. And what I had done had just been, you know, in a well-equipped lab. what you have to do in order to, well, even see the cells properly in the first place down the microscope, let alone differentiate between the different types of cells, was you stain them, like a lot of histology, you know, living tissues study down microscopes. You use various stains to bring out the different parts of a cell and that sort of thing. Okay, well, fine. We use the same microscope cell and so on, but we needed the stain. And yes. There was indeed, it's called Leishman's stain. There was indeed some Leishman's there, but it was just a jar of powdered, the powdered stain, which I'd never encountered before. As I say, what ones I had done all been done in a lab, and you reach for the bottle of stain. sort of read up the book and the textbook, and it says, okay, dissolve the powder in acetone. We didn't have any acetone. The nearest, you know, the only real sort of organic solvent we had. I mean, acetone is a very common organic solvent, of course, but we had no use for it on base, apparently, so there was none there. Really, the only organic solvent we had was methylated spirits. I think there was some distilled methylated spirits, you know, i.e. not dyed, if I remember rightly. I really know. Anyway, I thought, well, you know, that's all we can do. Let's try it, see what happens. So I tried dissolving some of this stain, and certainly some of it did dissolve, and then tried using that to stain the stain a sample of white cells, and well, it really wasn't working. But nevertheless, I had a go and sort of passed some very tentative results over to Mike, to which his response was, he's dead.
Were you ever able to refine the process?
No. I mean, the major problem is that this stain, this Leishman stain, I mean, it is itself an organic stain. I forget where. But it's a mixture.
Mm.
It's a mixture. And the real problem was that it was only half dissolving. Some of the mixture was dissolving in the alcohol, but some of it wasn't. So the cells weren't being properly stained, so they didn't. You didn't see what you expected, either from memory or from the pictures in the book.
A couple of other notes here. One is about having to feed Ken port wine with seal liver. Was that something you did? You're looking puzzled.
I don't recall that, I must say, but it's very obvious. His red cell count was going down. Liver equals iron in massive quantities. Iron is the classic treatment for and anemia.
Do you recall any airdrops that were taking place?
Ironically,
for toilet rolls.
That's right. Yes.
Amongst other things.
Yes, yes.
What else did they airdrop? A pumpkin.
Oh, that's right, yes.
What was that for?
I think it was just to weigh down. A lot of the stuff was in, or at least that particular one, I mean, I can't remember what else, was just in basically a kit bag, you know, right. A military-style kit bag. And I think the pumpkin was stuck in at the bottom just to give it some weight, so that as they kicked it out the door of the Hercules, you know, it was going to take a proper plummet in a reasonably predictable trajectory. Yes.
Let's just pause for a moment, if we can.
Yeah, sure.
And come back.